we'd like to welcome this week as our guest, Rubén Martínez, who is a journalist, author, musician, and poet. He's won a Lannan Foundation Fellowship and a Freedom of Information Act from the ACLU. His celebrated books include Crossing Over, The Other Side, Notes from the New LA, The New Americans, and his most recent, Desert America, among others. He really is a really great combination of many things. He's really someone who's really helping us understand not only immigration life, but immigration life in terms of globalization. He is, of course, of a second-generation Mexican-American on his father's side and Salvadoran on his mother's side. He grew up in L.A. He was born in 1962, a mere child from my perspective, but he's a class act and a wonderful writer, and I'm a huge fan, and it's a real pleasure to have Rubén on our show. Welcome to Words on a Wire, Rubén.
Thanks for coming.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, and thank you for that beautiful introduction, and likewise on all counts.
So you want to talk a little bit about the impetus behind your latest book, Desert America, and how that kind of came to be?
Sure. It started nowhere near the desert. It started in Mexico City. It started in 1997. I was living in Mexico City. I was under contract for a book, you know, with a New York publisher, the same publisher, as a matter of fact, Metropolitan, that published Desert America. And you've probably heard this story before from some other writers. I was lucky enough to have gotten an advance, and I had spent the entire advance, and I didn't have a single word written.
Oh, yeah, I have heard that story.
You heard that one?
Yeah. Each one is equally as interesting.
So continue, yeah.
Yeah, so the book literally begins in Mexico City. I'm broke, I'm broken, heartbroken, and I've broken a couple of hearts in a terrible, disastrous love triangle, as love triangles always are, and I'm on drugs. I had gone to Mexico City when I was much younger, you know, on what I imagined were roots trips, you know, to authenticate my Mexicano identity by climbing in La Pirámide del Sol, you know, and in Teotihuacan. But over the years, I kind of, you know, fell like an expat, like, you know, Malcolm Lowry or the Beats, you know, William Burroughs or something. I kind of fell into what they call the reventón in Mexico City, the party scene. And, you know, all these stories begin innocently enough, but of course, at a certain point, the innocence is lost and just, you know, kind of like a downward spiral. So, to make a long story short, I make a phone call to the last friend I can count on at that time, who happened to be living in the village of Joshua Tree, California. Her name is Elia Arce, a wonderful performance artist from Costa Rica, who we've collaborated for many, many years on a lot of projects. She had left Los Angeles for this little village in the Mojave Desert, basically looking for art, you know, looking to establish like an art, you know, colony in some ways. I mean, she wouldn't have said it that way, but that's what she was doing. She was looking for a cheap place to make her art and found this place in the desert. And she said, it was just a phrase, Rubén, vente para acá. I told her this out, the whole sad story. She said, come here, we'll take care of you, get you back on your feet. And that's where the story begins. I arrive in this desert on a healing pilgrimage. And those first couple of years, I get a crash course on how complicated the desert really is. And you guys know, you're there, of course, you know, by heart, all the different ways it can be complicated. But the biggest lesson for me was trying to reconcile the desert of my romanticized imagination, you know, whether it was kind of like vestiges of the Westerns, you know, that I'd kind of, you know, seen as a kid, or even the lore in my family, because my grandparents are both from desert lands in northern Mexico. And so there was a particular connection my family had when I was growing up, going into the desert. And so I had a really, you know, kind of like a soft, warm, fuzzy relationship to the place, to be honest, and had no idea of the human geography on it. And of course, you know, when I arrived in Joshua Tree, in pretty short order, I realized that my next door neighbors were doing math. You know, Marines training at the base, about to go overseas, doing drugs and spiraling out of control like I had just been spiraling out of control in Mexico City. So, you know, everything that I was fleeing, in other big bad city.
Was
I
there?
I don't think they came to see in the desert.
The book is a incredibly dense. I mean, it's filled with so much information. I've learned so much, but the language is so lyrical. It reads like a poem. And then you give us all this background about the desert, but then you'll go into the really extremely personal and touch on, for example, your addictions. And yeah. Was that a difficult place for you to go?
No. If anything, you know, my editor would probably, you know, if she was on the line, she would say, oh, no, he loves to go there. You know, if anything, the problem was too much first person.
Wow.
You know, that might sound, I don't know how that sounds in the context of, let's say, Borderlands, Chicano literature, you know. Uh-huh. I think back in the day, I think there was less confession than there is today, you know.
Right.
But I was really weaned on confessional writers. I have a trinity of writers that are kind of like my signpost. It's Joan Didion, mm-hmm. James Baldwin, and Richard Rodriguez.
Oh, wow.
And all three of them share kind of like this. They all have autobiography at the center of their essay writing.
Right.
You know?
Well, that's true, but I think you share more in common with Baldwin and Didion than you do with Richard Rodriguez. and I will tell you why I think that. It is because I think that Richard Rodriguez really, really looks inward because his journey is really to discover himself. And I think Didion and Baldwin both use the self to discover the world. And I think that's what you do. I think it was inevitable, I thought, though, that when you go into the desert, you know, I've probably said this before, but the desert, biblically speaking, is a place of encounter.
Oh, yeah.
And so that you go into the desert not only to discover your gods, but discover your demons.
Exactly.
You go there to be tested, but you also go there to be saved. And I'm wondering if you look at the desert ultimately as a place of salvation.
Yes. And that biblical narrative and deep symbolism that you're talking about is something that I only very slowly became aware of. You know, when I first arrived there, I was totally messed up. So I wasn't particularly self-reflective. You know, I didn't really see what I was doing. I couldn't have said in 1997 when I arrived in Joshua Tree that I'm here to begin a healing pilgrimage following in the footsteps of St. Anthony in the 4th century desert of Egypt, you know, going to battle my demons in a rock cave, you know. I didn't even know St. Antonio's story very well at that point. But over the years, through a series of encounters, and particularly just in the last few years at Loyola Marymount, where I teach in Los Angeles, the English department is right next door to the theology department. And I struck up a wonderful relationship with a theologian named Douglas Christie, whose specialization is the 4th century monastics, who did exactly that. They left kind of like the bustling Nile River Valley and went on this journey deep into the Egyptian desert and battled demons and then came back, re-entered society, but, you know, kind of like having, you know, the truth revealed to them and thus being able to live a different life upon re-entry into society. So all this came after the fact, this knowledge. But once I became aware of it, then I said, oh, yeah, well, that's not really a chance thing that I made that phone call to my friend in the desert. In some ways, it feels like I was fated to go there. That if I didn't go there at that particular moment when I was in Mexico City, if I didn't go there, I might not well have survived.
All right. We're talking to Ruben Martinez, author of Desert America.
Yeah, if I could coattail on this a little bit, there's that metaphor of Simon of the desert, you know, where Simon lives in the city and he's tempted by all the things of the world. So he goes to the desert so he could seek God. But then even the flames of the fire take on the shape of women and he ends up finding exactly what he was trying to run away from. And you kind of depict the desert in a way where the communities that you hang out with, even in the New Mexico desert, the proximity to the drug trade and the proximity to all these things that really reflect exactly what one would leave in a city.
Exactly. And it's that juxtaposition. I was about to say the word in Spanish, that's not quite juxtaposition, but disyuntiva. What would that be in English? Disjuncture. Right?
Yes, yes.
This juncture. It's very early on, I had the experience of these radically opposed lives and realities in the desert. and no reconciliation between them, between, you know, kind of the Desert West's version of the one and the 99. Just the sheer economic chasm that there is between rich and poor. I lived in northern New Mexico for several years after Joshua Tree, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that landscape, the kind of money that exists in Santa Fe, Los Alamos, and Taos, compared to the extreme poverty, and I use that phrase very purposefully, extreme poverty. Some people refer to that corridor as the Appalachia of the Southwest.
Right.
The Espanola Valley has one of the lowest per capita incomes in the entire United States. And it's right next door to three of the richest zip codes in the entire country.
Mm.
So, I look at it as I became aware of these distinctions and just the gulf between them, of these, you know, social strata. It bothered me to no end, you know, and I tried to figure out what my place was in between these places, because I was in between them in some sense. And it just bothered me. How could this wealth exist and erase, you know, the poverty right next door?
Mm-hmm.
Because you're able to take the 68, the low road to Taos between Santa Fe and Taos, and literally not see any sign of anything untoward, of any poverty or addiction as you take that road. What you're going to see is the beautiful strata of the mesas and the buttes, and the Taos Gorge, you know, it's almost like like a mini Grand Canyon. You're going to see the landscape, and you're going to remember the way it was captured by George O'Keefe or Ansel Adams or Blumenschein or Moran, all the great, you know, Santa Fe and Taos art colony painters. And you're not going to see the poverty that's right in front of your eyes. You can go to the Santuario de Chimayo, which is one of the Lourdes of the Southwest,
right?
You know, where you go and get your holy dirt and get healed.
Right.
And you will not know that literally within 200 yards, there's a shooting gallery for heroin. You won't see it because of the layers, I think, of imaginaries layered. It's like a postcard, you know, layered on top of the landscape through which we really can't see the other.
Well, it's because the beauty of the landscape lulls us into the... It wants us, it seduces us to mythologize about it. And yet we do forget that there are people who live on that landscape. It's almost as that all people become invisible.
And yes, that's wonderfully put. I agree totally. There is something, you know, it's like Wordsworth. You know, the idea of the sublime in Wordsworth, Wordsworthy in awe, you know, the awe before beauty, where we feel insignificant in front of natural grandeur. And so I think there's something very human about that feeling. You know, when we're alone in the wilderness, if we live in the city and we're alone in the wilderness, that radical difference, you know, can stun us and awe us.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes in a really sublime, what we experience as a sublime, but it can also terrify us, you know. Either way, it's an overwhelming experience of the landscape. And we begin to build a narrative about our relationship to the land in that vein, you know, that becomes monumental and which can tend to obscure a human narrative.
Yeah, and also I think that when people go into the desert and they're looking for the authentic desert, and that word authentic, of course, is troublesome. You point that out in your book. Once you look for something that's authentic, you're looking for your perception of what it's supposed to be. So you're really creating the desert in the image of yourself. And so you're going to find pretty much that the landscape is not going to reflect anything but what it is that you perceive to be you.
Right.
I'd like to go to that other desert that you experienced, and that was the desert in Marfa, which I think is very different than those other two deserts. Can you talk about that?
Oh, my gosh. And you guys you're in the neighborhood.
Right. We are in the neighborhood. My father was born in Fort Davis, by the way.
Oh, my God. Oh, wow. I'm thinking about the fire that just went through there a couple years ago.
Yeah,
that
exactly.
Devastating fire, of course. Well, I struck up a relationship with Marfa first in a romantic vein. My wife, Angela Garcia, and I, you know, Angela's an anthropologist who's written a book called The Pastoral Clinic that shares a lot of this narrative, because we were living together in northern New Mexico. That's why I went to northern New Mexico at first. So we took a road trip. We weren't married yet, and we had a summer off, and we decided to take a road trip, literally, only two Chicanas, you know, would think this is a fun thing to do in August. We decided to go all the way along the border from San Diego to El Paso.
Wow.
Literally the border road.
Right.
I'm not talking about the highways. I'm talking about the border road, you know. So it was half ethnography, you know, political project, but also kind of just wanting to get on the road, you know. And so we had all kinds of adventures, and we saw all kinds of crazy stuff. You can imagine, you know, we got stopped by the Border Patrol a million times. But eventually we get to El Paso and wanted to go to the Big Bend. And when we got down there, that experience of the landscape that we're talking about totally overwhelmed us. I had not really spent a lot of time in West Texas before, but it was stunning. I mean, the landscape just, you know, left us mute.
What a sky, huh?
Oh, my God. You know, and the Marfa Plain, the lyric beauty of the Marfa Plain, and then the contorted beauty as the landscape tumbles down to the Rio Grande, you know, mm-hmm. and then Mexico on the other side. I mean, I heard a soundtrack, you know, like from my childhood, you know, of strings and horns playing like a Hollywood movie on this landscape. And then we arrive at Boquillas del Carmen, right across the river from the Mexican village. And there's a big sign that used to say, you know, cross over and go to Boquillas to visit your Mexican neighbors. And this is just after 9/11, and there's a big black tarp over it.
Wow.
The border crossing had been closed. And the soundtrack, that romantic soundtrack from the Western, you know, immediately stopped, you know, and like taking an old record player and scratching the record with the needle, you know. So we were welcomed back into the known world, and we looked across at the Mexico that we could no longer go to legally, you know, or informally anyway, as it was referred to back then. And we started this relationship with the Marfa area, and many years later ended up doing the Lennon residency there, and wrote a good part of this book, actually, at the Lennon Writers Residency in Marfa.
Nice. Do you take photographs?
I do more now than when I was writing this book. I wish I had my iPhone back then. iPhone.
Turns everyone into a photographer, doesn't it?
Exactly. But, you know, the photographs, I mean, I tend to write visually.
Oh, absolutely.
And so I was, you know, trying to render in words what the photographs would be.
You did a lot of research, extensive research for this book. And one of the things that really captured my attention was what you discovered about D.H. Lawrence. I think we tend to romanticize D.H. Lawrence's trip to New Mexico as he was an enlightened man from Europe, tired of the European way and seeking something authentic. But you found something completely different. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Lawrence scholars might totally challenge me on this. Yeah. This is my interpretation. I had a complicated relationship with Lawrence when I arrived in New Mexico. On the one hand, I felt very much like I was arriving in New Mexico, not unlike him, very much an outsider. You know, that's the thing about New Mexico.
If you're not from there, you're an outsider.
Well, not yet. There's something in New Mexico in particular, northern New Mexico, the tenancy, the Hispano tenancy that goes back so many centuries, the land grants, the water rights in that area. I mean, history is lived in the present. You're walking into a diorama of history, and it's very contentious, and somebody's house going for sale with water rights on it can shake a community to its roots. And so we were entering that landscape. And ultimately, I found that I was the outsider. It didn't matter that my last name was Martinez,
right. That
my wife's name is Garcia. And by the way, our next-door neighbors had those two last names, too.
Isn't Angela from there?
But she's from the South Valley of Albuquerque.
Okay.
Which, to a norteño in northern New Mexico, that's like, what are you doing here?
Yeah.
Go back home.
Right, you know? Exactly.
And then for a guy from California who's half Salvadoran, I mean, that's like, you're from Mars, man.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I'm from Las Cruces in southern New Mexico, and I'm from Mars, too.
Exactly. So Lawrence, ultimately, I think I identify with Lawrence a little bit, you know, being, you know, the outsider. And looking at the other outsiders and trying to be outsiders of the outsiders, in a way, is what he was doing, I think. But he looks upon the Native American figure. You know, when I'm reading these essays about his time in New Mexico, I am going to the Turtle Dance on New Year's Day, you know, at San Juan Pueblo, now Owenge Pueblo. And so I'm seeing these things, like, you know, 75 years later or 90 years later. And I'm seeing what Lawrence is writing. And Lawrence is undeniably a rich and complicated and even radical figure in so many ways, in terms of how he represented, you know, sexuality and women and everything. But when he comes and looks at the native in the United States and the way he looks at Mexicans, the language is filled with, it's a diss, you know. He looks at the Indian as absolutely trapped in a pre-modern consciousness, all instinct. Everything exists below the belt for the Indian, is basically what he's saying.
Yeah.
And the Mexican Revolution has just taken place. And he thinks the Mexican Revolution is a failure, and it's basically illiterates mocking European democracy. So, and somehow, you know, that part of his writing, it's like we go to Sons and Lovers. We don't do a close reading of these essays from New Mexico necessarily, but they're not his best-known work.
We shouldn't be surprised if we look at that and then go back to his writing, that that would be his attitude.
No, because ultimately, you know, there's something, I think, about the way the Taos and Santa Fe art colonies, which are getting going, you know, the turn of the last century, very similar to what's happened, I think, in the last generation in the West. There's been all kinds of new art colonies that have arisen in the West in the last generation. So 100 years ago, a lot of bohemians and creative types wandered into the desert and started representing it. And they brought with them, you know, their prejudices. And I'm talking about, you know, both people who tended to be, I'm talking about people who tended to be progressive or liberal in the context of their time. But they still had all these kind of warped, you know, ways of looking at the other, the Native and Mexican other in particular. And so it might have been, in the case of somebody like Mabel Dodge Lujan, you know, who was Lawrence's patron in Taos, it was a kind of fetishization. They were Charles Lemis, the famous Southwestern, you know, writer, also. These are people who actually agitated on behalf of Native Americans, and sometimes for Latinos in the area, mostly Native Americans. But they also, you can also see a very, from today's perspective, you can see them essentializing the other, the Native.
Well, would you say that was really another kind of level of colonialism?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Unwitting.
Unwitting, yes.
Totally unwitting.
Yeah.
But yes, a part and parcel of the colonial project. And it's a cruel irony, right? I mean, you get all these painters. You know, both creative types, we tend to be, you know, liberal progressive, right? And I think that's always been the case. So you would expect these people to go into these areas, throw their lot in, you know, with the marginal communities. And they do, but they do it in a way where they don't really give up power, and especially the power of representation itself.
Many people have told me that colonialism is mostly a bad word in most places in the world, except in Santa Fe.
Oh, my God. I hadn't heard that one before. Yeah.
We're talking to Ruben Martinez, author of Desert America, Boom and Bust in the New Old West. It just came out. It's a fantastic book. And one of the things that struck me in the book, I like these little facts that you tell us about. Joshua Tree has always been a symbol for a retreat. Those who are looking for something and want to go in the desert and drop acid or find themselves, or an artist who is broke, like you said, will find refuge there. But one of the interesting facts about this, the book that you bring up, is how the famous U2 album Joshua Tree got its name. Can you tell us about that?
So, you know, when we listen to that album today.
The greatest album they made, right?
But critically, probably the most well-received in terms of criticism. And a huge seller. It totally, you know, took them to another level commercially. And when we think of those classic songs, you know, With or Without You, is the one that comes to mind immediately, right? But there were several hits in that album. When you listen to them now, and you think of it in relation to the name of the album, The Joshua Tree, inevitably, we, you know, call to mind a desert landscape. Whether or not we've been to Joshua Tree is immaterial, right? Immediately it calls to mind a desert landscape. We at least know that Joshua Trees grow in the desert somewhere, right? In the Mojave specifically. So we think of it as being a desert album. And indeed, I thought, you know, that with Daniel Lanois, the famous producer, that they'd hung out, because I'd heard stories, inaccurate as it turns out, that they'd hung out, you know, in Joshua Tree itself, and that this is where the inspiration for these wonderful lyrics, because there's real poetry in there. This is Bono at his best in terms of lyrical writing. And the metaphors there all appear to be, you know, kind of like deep Catholic desert kind of spiritual yearning, you know. The fact is, they'd never been to Joshua Tree. They'd recorded the entire album before they were on tour in the United States and had the album finished by that point, but they didn't have the cover art for it. And so they were in California for some gigs, and they took a trip to Joshua Tree because they heard it was a cool place to go. And they did a photo shoot. And they said, wow, it's so great. This landscape is perfect. It looks just like our album sounds. And so, you know, they slapped the Joshua Tree onto the title and put pictures of themselves in Joshua Tree all over the album, the cover art. It becomes a desert album.
And what a great metaphor for how we what we do to the desert.
Well, yeah, it's a kind of colonization of it, right? And that is, it's recolonizing the landscape, right? We're discovering it and subduing it and repurposing it, you know, for, you know, our narrative symbolic ends, you know? I'm not saying that that's always a bad thing.
Right, right.
But it's an act of, that the power of representation and naming things and, I mean, we all have to remember, and right now I'm going into professional mode, this is what I tell my students constantly, we just have to remember that the power representation is first and foremost a power.
Right.
And that it can be used for liberating ends. But so often it's used for the opposite. It's used to subdue people. And all colonial projects have artists, you know, charge of the Light Brigade. I mean, it's like, just think of how many, you know, Rudyard Kipling, and how many artists have been involved in the colonial project. And ultimately, I argue in the book, that the artists of the Santa Fe and Taos art colonies and the art colony in Marfa, specifically to these are modern art colonies, this is a latter-day art colony, right? Just mm-hmm. very recently founded. I argue very strongly in the book that the Marfa art colony has performed a kind of colonial project in that area and has very viciously, without saying that the artists are being vicious, mm-hmm. you know, they don't think of themselves as being vicious, mm-hmm. but in that area, they have completely erased the Mexican figure.
Right,
and I know you have some listeners probably in the area who know Marfa, and I might get some blowback from this, but I have a long chapter in the book, and I urge your listeners, you know, if they're interested, to read it and consider my argument,
right.
As tendentious as it might sound.
We've been talking to Ruben Martinez. We're just about out of time, Ruben. I'm going to close with one final question for you, and that is, do you think it's possible to experience the desert as a natural landscape? Is that possible to do that in a pure sense, you know, without our ideologies?
No, I don't. But that doesn't mean that all is lost. Because within our human perception, you know, an ideology is part of everything that we do. There are liberating forces, and there's the opposite of that, enslaving forces, right? And in the desert, I think we have perfected both good and evil. You know, this is sounding very Old Testament now, but the desert has taught us the extreme capitalism of boom and bust. You know, the one in the 99, that term could have been coined easily in Santa Fe or Phoenix or Denver over the last generation, just extremes, you know. And going back to the 19th century and the extremes in wealth and poverty going way back to the frontier, and the extreme changes in the area, the human geography. But in the desert also, a long, deep tradition is discovering the elemental truth that without hospitality and solidarity, you can't possibly cross that desert. You need the knowledge of the people who were there before you, and sometimes you need the help of the Samaritan who's got water, who's sending out water for you right now. If you're a migrant, if you're a Mexican migrant, going up the Tohono O'odham Reservation, near Pablo Kivery Peak, Mike Wilson, a man named Mike Wilson, from the Tohono O'odham Reservation, is putting out water right now for you. Mm-hmm. And without him there, you might not make it. So the desert is a place of extreme capitalism and our downfall, but it's also a place of the beauty, the human beauty of hospitality and solidarity.
Thank you, Ruben Martinez, for being on Words on the Wire. We'll be right back where Ruben will be reading our poem of the week.